Luego. Okay, I think we need to start now. So Vidita needs no introduction. Vidita Vaidya, she is a DBS professor whom we have marooned in this Hartmann area along with her group, and this is to keep, make sure that she and her group remains fit, you know, commuting up and down against all the weather elements and dogs. So her research topics are very interesting, as popular as she is. She works with, you know, who wouldn't like to know what, how many neurons are growing in an adult brain, what happens with antidepressants, as also, you know, what does the hippocampus do. But today I think she's going to say something quite different. Some gharanas that she's going to talk about, history of neuroscience, I gather. But anyway, we'll all be very curious to hear her. So, Vidita.
Thanks, Shobhna. You can hear me at the back there. You would even if I didn't have the mic, but I'm not too loud at the back there, right? So I guess that's more important to ask. Okay, so I've had lots of people ask me as to why this title. Is there anything called the neuroscience gharana? There isn't. I just made it up. There is certainly something called musical gharanas. I was inspired by that idea and have just cut and pasted that idea to neuroscience. So bear with me. It's an analogy that I'm going to try to see if I can build on. And why am I inspired by this idea? Well, the idea of musical gharanas, in particular in Hindustani musical music, every gharana has a very distinctive feature and essential style, obviously in the way in which musical notes are sung. There's also this whole lineage of Guru Shishya Parampara and how things get passed down that lineage. And in a sense, each gharana is distinctive in its characteristics and flavor, and often surrounds a central genius who really set that gharana up. And then once the Shishya has taken off sufficiently and become a genius in their own right, they can establish their own gharana in a sense, okay? So I want to take that idea and apply that to neuroscience as a field, and clearly it's not something that's an easy exercise to do. I could only come up with three gharanas that I could flesh out today for you, but it's a work in progress, okay? So you guys are my guinea pigs in a sense with this idea. So what is my caveat, which I should declare right at the very beginning? It's an incomplete and meandering and imperfect walk through these neuroscience gharanas, partly because it's biased by my own interests and inclinations, and it's incomplete because there's no way you could summarize the history of neuroscience in 45 minutes, okay? So I'm not even going to attempt to do it. I'm just going to try to talk about some of the central gharanas as I think of them, and the goal will be to identify who some of the gurus of these gharanas were and who are the current day exponents and shishyas of these gharanas, to try to see if there is a continual thread across this entire gharana, and were some central ideas common no matter whether they were done 100 years or 200 or 500 years ago, and the current modern day exponents are also still asking similar questions, perhaps with slightly different tools. So the first gharana that I'm going to talk about is the grave digger gharana, okay? It's as macabre as the name sounds, but pretty much everything that we know about the brain in a sense owes its origins to people who were brave enough to take material provided by these individuals who did a fine call, clarion call out for science. If they had not provided cadaver's brains and bodies, we would have known nothing about anatomy and certainly nothing about structure. The central theme of this gharana in a sense is to ask, what is the brain made up of? Okay. All the way back to 300 to 400 BC, Hippocrates, Aristotle were already cutting up cadavers. That idea was well and truly in practice, and there were actually books of anatomy. So more than 2000 years ago, there were books of anatomy. And then suddenly something happened post about 200 BC. All cutting up of bodies became heretical in a sense, or disappeared, or there's no track record of it, okay? So in a sense, this information that was preserved in Galen's textbooks from 1999 BC, 199 BC and AD, none of this has really, nothing happened for a good solid 1,000 years till about 13th and 14th century, which is when once again people were available, you know, they had cadavers available to actually look at. In the meantime, don't think people were not cutting up goats and oxen and other individuals. So other species were certainly being looked at, but certainly the human anatomy and the human brain wasn't looked at as carefully. And that is interesting because when you look at Galen's textbooks from 199 AD, you realize that a lot of it actually is very true, but it's true for the monkey and the ox and not necessarily as true for the human, which is what the textbook claimed it was true for. But without this man, this Renaissance man, you wouldn't have had anatomy in a sense. And he was an artist who was drawn into science constantly to be true to his drawings, and really in a sense, this is one of his drawings of what he thought was going on inside the skull. Keep in mind, this was not easy to do. The fixatives weren't in place. So when you sectioned the skull and took out the brain, this would have become mush in very short periods of time. To actually come up with any sense of architecture that was remotely close to what it really was not an easy task. And yet, in a sense, what he did was really exemplify this term, which is to draw is to understand. He would start drawing something, take up with the idea, and actually get drawn into the anatomy so much that he forgot the drawing and became more interested in the anatomy. So he was in that sense a scientist and an inventor much more so than he was an artist. The other contemporary of that era who was really doing anatomy in a sense was Michelangelo. He of course though was more an artist than he was in that sense an anatomist. However, the detail with which he rendered all his artistic paintings as well as sculptures tells us that he must have known anatomy really well. And this is the creation of Adam, which is on the Sistine Chapel. And I would like you to focus on the cloud that God is lying on here. So about 15 years ago or so, some clever medical student decided to draw out the traces of this and remove all this other stuff and simply look at individual traces and see if he could figure out what this cloud might represent. Turns out the middle cerebral artery enters right here. That's where the cerebellum would be coming out. That's where the pons is. And in a sense, this was an idea that he put forth. It was an article that he put forth in JAMA. We have no clue what Michelangelo was really trying to say. But there's a question mark as to whether he put God on a cloud that actually is almost perfect outline of the human brain, representing multiple parts of the brain in their entirety. The outline is perfect all the way down to the sulcus, which is the grooves and you actually can see the outline. The question is, are we looking for information here that he did not intend or not? I don't know. Here's the medical student who actually made that particular observation. But then our brain likes to complete patterns. What do you guys see here? You see anything here that jumps out at you? Let's see if somebody does pattern completion quickly. Yeah, there's somebody back there. Can you see a Dalmatian dog? Okay, then now once you've seen the dog, you will see it and not be able to stop seeing it. If you're still struggling to see the Dalmatian dog, then that's fine, but there's the dog. There's the ear of the dog, there's the head, there it is. There's this leg. So once you see the Dalmatian, it's really hard to stop seeing it. Our brain is a pattern completer in a sense, okay? So there's more Dalmatians, but you have to be supremely good at finding the patterns to find the Dalmatians. So apparently 101 Dalmatians in there, but the first one you can easily find. We'll have to spend a lot of time on this slide if we have to find the rest. Okay. But this gharana continued to thrive. It thrived across the century. So I was talking about 13th, 14th century. In the 18th century, the grave diggers made such a professional business out of this that there was an equally opposite business that started thriving, which was to provide iron stuff to protect the grave so that it could not be actually robbed and the bodies and cadavers could not actually be taken out. Burke actually set up a business where he started killing people in the hope of just providing sufficient number of cadavers for anatomical studies in med school at that point in time. That's what forced the Anatomy Act of the 18th century, which eventually allowed people to donate their bodies for scientific research. Without that, I don't know where we would have been, but those were the dark ages in a sense, where even murder happened in the name of providing sufficient number of cadavers for people who were working on medicine. But who then, along these centuries as we go along, would have been another major guru of this particular gharana? Well, you can't start this without talking about Ramon Cajal. Okay, Ramon y Cajal, a Spanish professor of anatomy, considered to be the father of modern neuroscience, sat with that tiny light microscope. So by then microscopy has come in, the idea of the cell has come in, so we are moving along in time. And he simply sat and drew for hours and hours and hours, systematically over and over again, layering out drawings of neurons one on top of each other, providing often three-dimensional understanding simply by drawing multiple different cells at a time, looking at who might be connected to each other. He also came up with a completely heretical idea in a sense at that point in time. Others at that point in time thought that these were not individual cells. It was one big fat nerve net. Everything was just connected to each other. It was a big long wire, and all these wires were just connected. In a sense, there was no gap and there were no individual cells. Cajal proposed the idea that each cell was a neuron, a nerve cell by itself. It was separated from the other nerve cell and there was a gap between the two. It would take another 50 years to show this actually, because you needed electron microscopy. Couldn't show it with light microscopy. So it would take another 50 years to really nail it down, which is why in a sense he shared his Nobel Prize with Camillo Golgi in 1906. Camillo Golgi was the proponent of the nerve net theory. He was a proponent of separate individual cells. Nobody could settle that debate. They equally shared the Nobel. Of course, Camillo Golgi also provided the very technique in a sense that provided this ability for Cajal to actually go through this and do these kinds of drawings, which was essentially silver chromate dyes, which allowed you to precipitate individual populations of neurons, and then you could actually draw the whole architecture. But Cajal was truly an artist at heart. With great detail and meticulousness, he looked at how neurons might change over time, providing us understanding that their entire architecture changes. So we've gone from looking at large, big things that could not be looked at underneath the microscope to getting detailed microscopic information. And this is already by the turn of the last century, 20th century. Who are today's modern exponents of the grave digger gharana, as I have named it? They are people who don't have to be artists, thankfully, because otherwise, like many people in this room who probably wanted to give up biology in their 10th standard or 11th standard because they had to draw all kinds of horrible diagrams, you'll be wiping out a generation of other biologists simply because you can't draw. You don't have to draw anymore. You simply use genetic paints. So you are using genetic tools to switch on green, yellow, blue, the colors of your choice in populations of neurons, allowing you to paint the brain rather than painting on a sheet of paper. So you're really painting in a sense. And these guys, Joshua Sains and Jeff Lichtman, in a sense really represent that gharana and the current exponents of that gharana. They made what's called the Brainbow Mouse, called the Brainbow Mouse because the brain is painted in all the range of possible colors. These colors come from fluorescent proteins of different kinds expressed in individual neurons. So each neuron will fluoresce a different color, allowing you to look at where and what it looks like, who it's connected to, who its neighbors are, and really to get an entire detailed set of information. So if you look at Guru Shishya samples side by side, this is Cajal's drawing of a specific kind of very beautiful neuron in the cerebellum called the Purkinje cell, known to be quite dramatic in the nature of dendrites. So these are the receiving branches for this particular nerve cell. A really exuberant branch is what this particular cell type is characterized by. And you can see that when you start painting them in different genetic colors now, with individually different, so here this would be one that expresses green fluorescent protein. Cyan would be expressed in another one, and you can actually really start getting a sense of the architecture. What? So about 20 microns to 40 microns is an individual cell, but of course the dendritic arbors can be significantly more than that. So how do we do this? They, instead of using a palette on which you take colors and mix colors, what they did is they used a genetic palette. So if you have CCC, three different genes in the genome, each of them coding for a particular color, in this case blue, then if with these three copies all being blue, you'll get blue. If you get CCY, the combination of having Y in there starts making you light blue. Much the same way, here you could be RRR and you will be red. Depending on the combination of genes that you have in the genome and which particular combination of proteins you express, the combination of the proteins gives you a different color, in a sense, okay? And in a sense, I still think these neuroscientists are artists at heart, because what they're still continuing to do is paint the brain, except they're not doing it on paper anymore. They're now painting it inside the nervous system, okay? And what do we know based on this? Well, we know a lot more. We know that a mouse has about 75 million neurons in its brain now. We have a reasonably good estimate that it's about 86, you know, something like 100 billion, so about 86 billion neurons is what people are estimating for the human brain. We have a pretty good guess that at about 10,000 synaptic contacts for each neuron, and the possibility that each neuron makes 10,000 synaptic contacts, something like a quadrillion synapses in the human brain. The problem with this entire mapping is that each of them is, in a sense, different. They're different in their connections. They could be different in the kind of chemicals that they make. They're certainly very often different in the genes and proteins that they make in these cells, the receptors that they have, and the kind of contacts they make. So what's the next big challenge? Where will the next generation of people in this gharana go? They go down what's called the Big Connectome Project, the huge project that the US has now put billions of dollars into to essentially map out the entire human brain, understanding each neuron's connectivity to get a complete map. Will getting that map necessarily tell us about how the way the brain functions? Not always the case. We know the map pretty well for the worm. It's about 302 neurons. We still don't know everything that the worm does. So that's another level. But we have no clue at the moment about large number of the maps in the human brain. So I'll play this video, because this gives you a sense about what are the current things that this particular gharana is up to.
We're heading into the center of a mouse's brain, into the hippocampus where memories are formed. Looking up, you can see neurons projecting to the surface of the brain. This is the work of Carl Dicerov and his team at Stanford University. By making the entire brain transparent, they were able to image it using a light microscope. They call the new technique Clarity. Existing techniques for studying the brain's wiring are often limited to looking at very small volumes of brain, or they don't allow you to label genes or chemicals of interest. The advantage of Clarity is that you can label lots of molecules in whole brains. So how do you make a brain transparent? The thing that obscures the view is fat. Lipid layers surround each cell. To remove them without disrupting the cell structure, the team used a hydrogel to create a mesh to hold the rest of the components in place. Then they could clear away the fat. This is a mouse brain before and after. The brain is now transparent to light, but it's also permeable to molecules, which means scientists can add molecular markers to highlight specific features. In this 1 millimeter block of hippocampus, excitatory neurons are green, inhibitory neurons are red, and cells called astrocytes are blue.
So this just gives you a sense of where this field is going now. If you did not have this capacity to actually see through the thickness of the brain, you'd have to systematically go through serial section after serial section after serial section and reconstruct everything to get a sense of its connectivity. This, just in a year, changed the playing field completely, because I don't see now this being a problem. So what we did is just simple stuff. Detergent, SDS, followed by poly, you know, using acrylamide. So I mean, what seemed straightforward techniques, but just hadn't been done before, and made, rendered the brain entirely transparent, and in doing so, changed the scale of the problem completely. This should be now much, much easier to solve. And they've begun to do this on human tissue. So in this video, I'll just continue it a little bit. The next thing you'll see is human brain. Of human
the
brain.
Technique works in human brains too. This is a chunk of the frontal lobe of a 7-year-old boy who had autism. It's possible to trace the path of a single nerve projection through a forest of other cells. When the team looked closely in one layer of the cortex, they noticed ladder-like patterns where neurons had connected back to themselves and to other neurons.
So this matters because in very quick succession, things that were found in rat models, mouse models of disease, are instantaneously being asked in the human situation, and you can ask if what you see in animal models is true in the human or not. So this gharana has been a really interesting gharana. Populated with a lot of artists in a sense, because even whether you can paint or not, if you like the singular beauty of the brain, you end up very often in this particular team. Microscopists, chemists, lots of people who generated dyes, generated ways via which to clear the brain. I mean, technology that came in from those approaches. Several doctors, because initially that was the realm of anatomy. It was physicians who were actually cutting and slicing through the brain. Anatomists, geneticists who are painting the brain in genetic tools, engineers and others. So let's make a switch now to another gharana, okay? So this is the map maker gharana, also known as a hole in the brain gharana, okay? And there's a reason perhaps why you'll see why I have these names for these gharanas. So the oldest exponent of this gharana got it all wrong, but I must give him due credit. It's Franz Joseph Gall, who came up with the idea of phrenology, which is that the bumps on your head tell you about your characteristics and personality. So if you have a very bumpy front of your forehead, you're a very benevolent creature. You can see there is benevolence, right? So a very large protrusion on this side is likely to tell you that you're very benevolent. His idea was that these bumps would give him a sense of what was actually, how much brain was there underneath, potentially pushing out against the skull, and this might predict personality types. But as a map, he started the idea that functions might be distributed in locations of the brain, even though he got all of this completely wrong. But we wouldn't know about the possibility that specific locations do specific things in the brain without what was, in a sense, the strange case of Phineas Gage. So Phineas Gage was a railroad worker in Vermont, and he used to use gunpowder to basically drill holes, and he had an iron rod, about 3-foot iron rod that he was using, and the gunpowder went off, and the thing went through his head, came out from the other side, flew across a football field literally that size and landed elsewhere. He was fine. He apparently didn't lose consciousness, was not in pain, because within your nervous system you have local pain, but within your brain you actually don't have pain perception. So if the injury is inside, you don't really feel it. You probably feel the injury from the wounds outside much more. Went to the doctor, who basically just cleaned up the little bits of skull that were left and left him, and he started recovering. And he actually completely recovered as far as the injury was concerned, except he was no longer Phineas Gage. Why am I saying he was no longer Phineas Gage? Because his personality completely changed. He went from a very pleasant, easygoing guy to somebody who was crude, uncaring, impulsive, irrational, and really antisocial. So there was a dramatic change in his personality that people noticed, and Turns out the brain region that got damaged in this is the ventromedial region of the frontal lobe, which actually regulates the processing and top-down control of inappropriate or emotion that you actually need to tamp down on. This is a circuit that my lab spends a lot of time working on. But we would not have even known where to look, because as you know, there are 100 billion neurons, there are lots of brain regions. Where do you start looking for function? So function and maps originally came literally based on chance discoveries, strange accidents, and careful observations made by doctors. Okay, it would not have happened otherwise. I guess if it had shattered, it would have been a problem. So like a bullet goes in there and everything fragments. This just went straight through and through. So this, actually the skull is at Harvard in their museum. And you can see that it looks like even the rest of the skull is not really shattered. It's just that hole and the hole at the top, and it's going straight through and out. So in a sense, it's almost, and by the way, this resulted in a very unfortunate series of things that happened after that. Because of the change in his personality, people began to think that psychiatric patients probably should have frontal lobotomies, because it's this part of the brain that is responsible for erratic behavior. And they actually took out the frontal lobe. So a series of psychiatric patients who went through frontal lobotomies as a consequence of these series of experiments. An unfortunate series of things that happened in medicine, because it did nothing for the disease, it just made them pretty much incapable of really functioning normally. So, but yeah, it did not cause major lesions. And this is not an area that is vascularized to the extent, if it had been the back of the brain, he wouldn't have been alive. But the frontal area does not control breath, does not control any of those key functions. So an injury in that area, unless there's whiplash and actually injures the back of the brain, you can actually get away with it. Yeah, it went straight through. So, okay. So this is a gharana that is really populated by lots of doctors. So Broca, for example, had a patient who came in after having a stroke, incapable of producing any words. He just was able to say tan. Okay, that was the word that he said. And in fact, that word has become famous in neurology, because that was the only word he could say. He would say tan over again. And when he died, they looked at his brain and turned out he had a lesion in this area. He also got a second patient who had a very similar situation, just couldn't speak, and was speaking completely normally before the stroke, completely lost the ability to speak. Looked at the brain, realized the lesion was in this area, decided that that must be the area that produces speech. It's the Broca's area. Wernicke, a decade later, had another series of patients who had another kind of aphasia. They could speak very long sentences, but the sentences made no sense. They were complete gobbledygook. Okay, these patients could understand everything. Okay, these patients could also understand, but were not able to make any meaningful sentences at the end of it. So how would this actually look like? So suppose you wanted your patient who had Broca's aphasia to repeat this sentence or something very close to it, which says, the dog needs to go out, so I will take him for a walk. What would a patient with Broca's aphasia manage to get out, if they manage to get anything out at all, because they really have speech processing problems? It would be something like walk dog. Okay, that's the maximum you can produce. So that area gets lesion, that's the kind of speech defect you're looking at. What about in Wernicke's area? In Wernicke's area, there's no speech production problem, but there's inability to create meaningful speech. So it could be something like, you know, that snoodle pinkered, and that I want to get him round and take care of him like you want before. It makes no sense. It's a long sentence. Each word, well, other than snoodle and pinkered, many words actually make sense, but as a sentence, it makes absolutely no sense. Okay, so this is Wernicke's aphasia. This led to our first understanding of those circuits in the brain that produce speech and through which we comprehend speech and also create comprehensible speech. Okay? But the best of the map makers is this man. Okay? Changed our entire understanding of how the brain works, in a sense, Wilder Penfield, a surgeon at McGill. What he did was open brain surgery. And this was the only way to treat epilepsy, which was intractable. No, patients were not responding to even what was available as medication. So the only way to do it was to take out the part of the brain that was producing the epileptic seizure. You only want to take that part out and not something else that is actually important for the individual to have. So you go with an electrode. A person is anesthetized on local anesthesia. The brain is open, so they're absolutely awake, and you're going with an electrode and asking, what do you feel when I, you know, stimulate this location? And you move a little couple of millimeters. What do you feel when I stimulate this location? So you go along the entire cortex doing this. And he went along the entire motor cortex and the entire touch sensory cortex. Okay, that part of the brain that processes touch. And as he walked along, he noticed, so here, this is the motor part of the cortex. You can see how much we dedicate in terms of space in the brain to our face. All the muscles in our face, okay, lots and lots of brain territory dedicated to that. Much the same way, look at the sensory. What is our brain dedicating to our body to process touch? We're dedicating a lot of space to our fingers, our thumb, certainly less to the foot, but not bad to the foot. The torso is here, okay, this tiny little thing. That's it. So touch processing from this region, you know, really not worried about too much information coming from here. We don't have discrimination power here, okay? We can't tell two touches very well and easily. But on your fingertips, you have the most beautiful discrimination ability, which is why we can do braille, okay? Because that detailed information can be actually processed. So he set out these maps, what is called the motor and the sensory homunculus, which is the map of your body on the brain. And this is what the homunculus looks like. So if you ask your brain, please draw out what you think the touch proportions of your body are, draw out the body, this is what the brain thinks your body looks like. Your brain pretty much thinks you're all hands, large amount of mouth and jaw, to some extent, hardly any torso, certainly very little upper arm and thigh. This is the way space in your brain is dedicated to touch coming from your body, okay? Does it matter? Can you change these maps, okay? That was the next series of questions that people started asking. I mean, this is that gharana that went with starting with maps and asking, are maps permanent? Can maps actually move? Turns out maps can get modified. So if you look at a monkey, digit 1, digit 2, digit 3, digit 4, digit 5, okay? 5 digits. Represented on that part of the monkey brain that processes touch without any training or by making the monkey do tons and tons of training, what you do with 2, 3 and 4, you train these fingers and the territory for 2, 3 and 4 will expand. Okay, so you can start expanding your map, you can start shrinking your map. If you fuse 2 and 3 by stitching them together, but then 2 and 3 become one fused representation. Even though the nerves are going completely differently, your brain thinks of them as just one finger. That's all I care about. It doesn't matter if they are two different fingers. They've been stitched together. Okay? If you get rid of a finger, you lose the territory to whoever's next door. Much like what would happen if you lost your parking or something like that, right? So things that are around will take over in a sense. So if you cut off digit 3, if you remove digit 3, then 2 and 4 will invade the territory that 3 has, and 2 and 4 will take up much more space in a sense. So those of you who have read this book by V.S. Ramachandran, Phantoms in the Brain, would know that it's based on those ideas of map making that come from Wilder Penfield and others, that he showed and looked at very carefully the part. So here's, for example, the normal sensory touch part of the cortex. Okay, this is the homunculus, sensory homunculus. Of course, you have a hand. If you don't have a hand, if you were amputated and you don't have a hand, then what happens? Well, face invades. Okay, because face happens to be next to the hand in the representation. So it matters who's next to you. You won't invade the pharynx over there, okay? Because it has to then override. It's whoever's under, right next to you. There are many questions about how this happens. Are there silent connections which we don't know about, which just pop up because the dominant connection is gone? Okay, many, many questions that we don't know about. And this is work. V.S. Ramachandran clinically really did dramatic things for people who had phantoms. So here's an individual who has an amputated arm and the map is actually showing up on his face now. Okay, so he actually feels when you touch his face that you're touching a finger, which he doesn't have anymore, because his face is taking over that area. So that brain still thinks there's a hand left, even though there is no hand, okay? So your brain, eventually, it's all about how you recreate the world in your nervous system. So even if you've lost the periphery, Your brain still thinks it continues to exist. Where do I go from this, in this map-making idea? I go from there to somebody who shaped the entire field of memory research, Brenda Milner. And I'll let this happen with a cartoon. I know there are some kids who came in, so this should be something that you guys will absolutely be able to get.
On September 1st, 1953, William Scoville used a hand crank and a cheap drill saw to bore into a young man's skull, cutting away vital pieces of his brain and sucking them out through a metal tube. But this wasn't a scene from a horror film or a gruesome police report. Dr. Scoville was one of the most renowned neurosurgeons of his time, and the young man was Henry Molaison, the famous patient known as H.M., whose case provided amazing insights into how our brains work. As a boy, Henry had cracked his skull in an accident and soon began having seizures, blacking out, and losing control of bodily functions. After enduring years of frequent episodes and even dropping out of high school, the desperate young man had turned to Dr. Scoville, a daredevil known for risky surgeries. Partial lobotomies had been used for decades to treat mental patients, based on the notion that mental functions were strictly localized to corresponding brain areas. Having successfully used them to reduce seizures in psychotics, Scoville decided to remove HM's hippocampus, a part of the limbic system that was associated with emotion, but whose function was unknown. At first glance, the operation had succeeded. HM's seizures virtually disappeared, with no change in personality, and his IQ even improved. But there was one problem. His memory was shot. Besides losing most of his memories from the previous decade, HM was unable to form new ones, forgetting what day it was, repeating comments, and even eating multiple meals in a row. When Scoville informed another expert, Wilder Penfield, of the results, he sent a PhD student named Brenda Milner to study HM at his parents' home, where he now spent his days doing odd chores and watching classic movies for the first time, over and over. What she discovered through a series of tests and interviews didn't just contribute greatly to the study of memory, it redefined what memory even meant. One of Milner's findings shed light on the obvious fact that although HM couldn't form new memories, he still retained information long enough from moment to moment to finish a sentence or find the bathroom. When Milner gave him a random number, he managed to remember it for 15 minutes by repeating it to himself constantly. But only 5 minutes later, he forgot the test had even taken place. Neuroscientists had thought of memory as monolithic, all of it essentially the same, and stored throughout the brain. Milner's results were not only the first clue for the now familiar distinction between short-term and long-term memory, but showed that each uses different brain regions. We now know that memory formation involves several steps. After immediate sensory data is temporarily transcribed by neurons in the cortex, it travels to the hippocampus, where special proteins work to strengthen the cortical synaptic connections. If the experience was strong enough, or we recall it periodically in the first few days, the hippocampus then transfers the memory back to the cortex for permanent storage. HM's mind could form the initial impressions, but without a hippocampus to perform this memory consolidation, they eroded like messages scrawled in sand. But this was not the only memory distinction Milner found. In a now famous experiment, she asked HM to trace a third star in the narrow space between the outlines of two concentric ones, while he could only see his paper and pencil through a mirror. Like anyone else performing such an awkward task for the first time, he did horribly. But surprisingly, he improved over repeated trials, even though he had no memory of previous attempts. His unconscious motor centers remembered what the conscious mind had forgotten. What Milner had discovered was that the declarative memory of names, dates, and facts is different from the procedural memory of riding a bicycle or signing your name. And we now know that procedural memory relies more on the basal ganglia and cerebellum, structures that were intact in HM's brain. This distinction between knowing that and knowing how has underpinned all memory research since. H.M. died at the age of 82 after a mostly peaceful life in a nursing home. Over the years, he had been examined by more than 100 neuroscientists, making his the most studied mind in history. Upon his death, his brain was preserved and scanned before being cut into over 2,000 individual slices and photographed to form a digital map down to the level of individual neurons, all in a live broadcast watched by 400,000 people. Though HM spent most of his life forgetting things, he and his contributions to our understanding of memory will be remembered for generations to come.
So HM passed away a couple of years ago. He was called HM for all of us. We didn't know what his name was. We had studied about him in textbooks. We only knew his full name, Henry Gustav Wallachian, once he passed away because his identity was protected. Completely changed our understanding of memory research. Explicit memory, which is remembering the path from here to the gate. Well, you remember it because if you tell it to somebody else, you can communicate it to somebody else, right? You'll be able to say, go out, then turn right, then go straight, you'll get to, you can communicate that map. That's an explicit or declarative memory. But if I have to tell you, teach the other person to walk, you don't have to remember. If I want to bicycle, you'll have to, once you learn how to bicycle, you don't even think about it. Those are implicit procedural memories processed in two different parts of the brain. So who now are the modern exponents of the mapmaker gharana? The mapmakers figured out what parts process touch, vision, taste, smell, hearing, many more things, many more functions which got parcelated, and location became really key in the brain. Well, the three most recently got the Nobel Prize, Ed Moser, Maybrit Moser, and John O'Keefe. John O'Keefe was a student at McGill where Brenda Milner did her work, and where Wilder Penfield set up the entire mapmaker gharana. So you can actually see that there are lineages here of actually having training across the years. So how do we create a map of our world in the brain? Okay, up till now I've shown you how you create studies that allowed us to understand how we create a map of our own body in our brain. How do you map your finger touch in your brain, right? But how do you map what is not even attached to your body? How do you start mapping what you do not have sensory information from other than visual in a sense and auditory? Okay, how do you start creating a map for that? So this was discovered purely by fluke, and this is an example of somebody thinking that they're just getting bad data over and over again till the bad data stares you in the face and you realize it's actually unbelievably good data, Nobel Prize winning data. So this was a rat, which is John O'Keefe's experiment in 1971. It's an illustration of it, and I'll walk you through it. If there's something I say that's confusing, please stop me, okay? So here's a rat. It's exploring an arena, okay, one broad box. You have electrodes implanted into the hippocampus, which we know regulates information about location, place, how to get somewhere, what something is, where to go, all of that. Okay, we knew that already by lots of lesion studies before that in animal models, starting with Henry HM and then being translated to animal models. So now you stick in electrodes into the brain so you can record the electrical impulses fired by these neurons, and since you are recording from, let's say in this case, 5 or 6 neurons, or even let's say 1 neuron, depending on what you're recording from, you look at where the animal is exploring, which is shown in black. So the animal likes to explore, so it's wandering all around this box, okay? So this little arena represents this here in black. All these traces means that the animal has actually wandered through that area. The red represents when the neuron fired. So the neuron fired only when the rat was in this location in the arena, largely. Okay, so this is what he noticed over and over again, depending on which population of neurons, different neurons fired in different locations. Turns out, neurons in the hippocampus are place cells. They create maps of the world in which we are navigating, and they map the arena by actually creating a map within, by saying this neuron will fire followed by this neuron, and you create an actual map. So if you have multiple neurons you're recording from, cell 1, cell 2, cell 3, cell 4 in the hippocampus, and here's a rat, and now it's walking not in anything but a linear path like this. This cell fires here, so cell 4 fires here. cell 2 fires here, cell 1 fires here, and cell 3 fires here, in that order, because that's the direction in which the animal is going to go. Now when the animal comes back, it will reverse play itself. Okay. So these are the place fields of these cells, in a sense that this cell cares about only when the animal is in this location. That's when it fires. This has led to many, many interesting ideas. Work coming from Matt Wilson's lab at MIT shows that when animals go through such mazes and they go to sleep, during REM sleep, when they're dreaming, they replay the precise same order in which place cells fired in a maze that they spend time learning. The same order is played out in sleep. It's played out either speeded up or slowed down, one of the two. And if you do not allow REM sleep and this replay to happen, the animal does not learn a maze. This is a very simple maze, so there's nothing to learn here. But if it's a complicated enough maze where food is located in a specific spot, then the animal has to learn this maze, right? So usually for these things, the animal has to be motivated enough. Just walking up and down is not exciting enough for the rat. There's to be something that the animal is actually working towards. But if you don't allow this replay, you can't learn. What does this actually look like? I mean, what does this sound like? Okay, so let's listen to recordings from Matt Wilson's lab, where you have a rat sitting right here who's going to wander through this maze. Okay, and you see neurons firing, and now these are tetraode recordings, so you are hearing multiple neurons, and each neuron is colored, so its spike is colored, so you'll see if it's blue, those same neuron is firing at that time. And that's been labeled, okay? So just to make it a little easier for representation. So there's a neuron that cares about that location. So same neuron firing all the way here in this corner. That's a blue neuron. So if you follow the blue neuron, you'll see where it, what territory it cares about, in a sense. All right. What about the guys who actually work with humans? What happens if you start giving your hippocampus a workout? Okay. So work from Eleanor Maguire at University College London. This idea that place cells are in the hippocampus, that place cells encode location, and that the hippocampus actually really encodes memory for location, in a sense, and is critical for the encoding of that memory, led to work that was done on London taxi drivers. Now, London taxi drivers have to study London roads, which are a maze. If anybody has ever navigated them behind the wheel of a car, you will know that everything is either one way or narrow or a dead end or an alley. It's very hard to actually start creating a map of London in your brain, and people who become London taxi drivers study for the exam extensively and take a long time to actually prepare for it. And she profile them over time to see if there were changes happening in the brain, looking at volume in the hippocampus. And here's what her work starts showing, that if you look at the time spent as a taxi driver in months, the voxels dedicated to the hippocampus, so now you're looking at volume dedicated to the hippocampus in MRI scans, actually increases. You can also follow this with retirement, and more recently they've done that to see how they do on retirement. They've also tested it with virtual reality to see whether the size of the hippocampus is a good predictor of being able to navigate a virtual reality maze, and it appears to be. So I'm going to end the Mapmaker Gharana by telling you that this has had physicians in its origins, really the physicians in their origins. Also has had extremely important patients whom, without whom the physicians would have had nothing to do. So Phineas Gage and HM are two individuals through which we really had a completely altered understanding of the brain. Lots of psychologists who've actually tested patients and also done experiments in animals, electrical engineers, people who did set up MRI and PET imaging that has completely changed the nature of looking at these maps, and also interestingly some of the best writers in neuroscience. So Oliver Sacks, V.S. Ramachandran would belong to this gharana, and they are the most effective communicators of neuroscience out to the public at large. Perhaps the biggest lesson one gets from this gharana is the use it or lose it lesson, in a sense, because if you do not utilize circuits, they will decay. You will give away terrain to what you're actually using it for. So many of you who write with a pencil now will realize that, unlike when you were in your fifth standard and could write remarkably fast and remarkably well, that ability is gone. So if any of you are put into a test with a fifth standard student writing an exam, you will not be able to sustain the speed that is required to actually generate. But if you go on, you do this, we're rewiring our brain by going virtual and on to this completely different circuits that are required from pencil writing. So I can actually stop, and I have one gharana, but it's a nasty stuff gharana, but I can stop. So quickly, 2-3 slides. Okay. So this is a gharana that, again, is a really old gharana, and I particularly like this gharana. It allowed us to understand how the brain actually works. Without cobra toxin, we would know nothing about the neuromuscular junction. Without the puffer fish, we would not have known that sodium is the ion that actually carries nerve conductances. That's how neurons fire. We would not have known this. Without venoms that came from curare, without venoms that come from cone toxins, without psilocybin and other things like LSD, etc., molecules that got synthesized based on magic mushrooms, we know nothing about what are consciousness altering chemicals. So this is the nasty stuff gharana. It was first used for biological warfare, okay? So when we talk about biological warfare today, biological warfare is very old. So people were using this like more than 2,000 years ago, where they used to throw venomous snakes into the enemy ships as a way to kill them and flush them out. So this is certainly, that was Roman warfare strategy, actually, to put in venomous snakes. But the cobra, the coral snake, changed our understanding of neuron synapses and what are the proteins of the synapses. We would never know the structure of these proteins without these toxins. We use these toxins to pull down all of those particular proteins. And the nasty stuff gharana had empiricists. There were many, many people who were willing to try small amounts of drugs themselves. Thankfully, this is now no longer part of this gharana, but many, many people tried a little bit on themselves and figured out how it worked. Lots of chemists, pharmacologists, engineers, physicists. So this is a gharana that many, many physicists went into and used these tools to actually understand what was happening within the neuron. Hodgkin and Huxley, who figured out that sodium current is actually what is responsible for, this ionic current is what is causing a neuron to fire. They would never have figured it out if they did not have a puffer fish. The puffer fish makes a toxin that blocks the sodium channel. Because it blocks the sodium channel, you can figure out exactly which aspect of an action potential or a neuron firing is mediated through by sodium. You have to still, it's still a delicacy, by the way, and you have to sign off that you have, free the chef of any responsibility in case after eating the puffer fish something happens to you. But without that puffer fish, we would not have known. And so this is what the puffer fish looks like, fugu. And so it's essential to have made that understanding. And this is what's actually going on in the neurons.
We're going to be looking at these electrical impulses, these flashes, which are called action potentials, are crossing three neurons in a circuit here. And as we look in higher power, you can see it crosses the synapse, moves on to the next neuron in the circuit, crosses another synapse, finally
this is
activates
the
next neuron.
Idea originally, and those are the synapses.
We
begin to
focus at slow speeds and at higher magnification. We're going to focus on the information transfer at that single synapse. And so there is the dendrite on the right, the synaptic terminal on the left. And as the impulse information comes down, these little green discs are channels in the synaptic terminal that open. They
there
let
are lots of drugs that
the
block these channels, prevent all neurotransmission.
Small packets of
many poisons that do that,
which release their contents into the gap.
Many poisons that force everything out, so you have muscle spasm and then paralysis because nothing is left.
On target neurons, they
many
open
poisons
further
that block these receptors, preventing
so
other
this
sites
information
from
transfer propagates from one neuron to the next.
And the snake venom which is perhaps the one that originally led to this idea. So here you imagine that you have a neuron that's going from your brain to your spinal cord and one from your spinal cord that's going to this muscle, okay? At the muscle synapse, where my muscle is in contact with the presynaptic or the neuron that's coming in, there are receptors for a neurotransmitter. These receptors are acetylcholine receptors. The toxin from the snake, alpha bungalotoxin, goes and binds to those receptors, which means that I can't do this. That's it, finish. Everything's going to paralyze. Probably my hands don't matter so much, but my lungs certainly matter, which is how you are finished off if you happen to not get antivenin fast enough, okay? Botox, however, made Amgen a ton of money. That's the same idea. Botulinum toxin blocks the exact same receptor, except that you can control the doses. Because you can control the doses, Bollywood and Hollywood can continue to look frozen for decades and the exact same age because nothing wrinkles, because you can paralyze the muscles. The local muscles can be mildly paralyzed, so nothing then moves, right? So it's all, so that's made large amount of money for people. Hemlock, by the way, so plant-derived substance which also hits the exact same receptor. Who are today's current exponents? I would say Baldomero Toto Oliveira is probably the best known example of this gharana. He works with cone snails. And he's taking the toxins from the cone snail all the way to the clinic. And I'm going to end with this video only because this is the most innocuous looking animal you could ever imagine. I mean, you see it, you collect it, you play with it, you don't even think about it. And those are amongst the most poisonous creatures out on our planet. Krishnan spent a fair bit of time in the more latter part of his scientific career working on picking up these and collaborating with Toto Oliveira to actually identify what is the cocktail of toxins that these very innocuous looking animals produce. And I'll end with this.
Crawling along the ocean floor is a cone snail. It looks harmless, but appearances can be deceiving. Four tubes jut out from its shell. The long one at the top is a siphon, which it uses to inhale water and detect prey. The smaller ones on either side are its eye stalks, and in the middle, a deadly proboscis. Concealed within the tip is a lethal weapon. A harpoon loaded with a neurotoxic mix so complex there is no antivenom to thwart it. It's armed with at least 100 different toxins, more than any other creature. When some cone snails go hunting, they like to burrow into the sand and wait. When a meal happens by, the cone snail fires its harpoon. The poisons quickly paralyze the fish. Once its prey is helpless, the cone snail retracts it through its proboscis until it engulfs the fish, swallowing it whole. The snail is no longer hungry, and its appearance no longer harmless.
So the reason I'm showing you that is every current major pain medication that the pharma industry is looking at, they're looking at targets here. Everything that we have currently are things like opioids, most effective, but highly, highly, highly addictive. Big risk of using those as painkillers. That's the only thing we have. So if somebody is in severe pain, all we have are analgesics that are drug dependence inducing. These cocktails that these cone snails make appear to be so unique and so interesting and so distinct that it is a serious effort now to actually understand what the targets are of something like 100 to 200 peptides per cone snail. Okay, and there are hundreds and hundreds of species of cone snails. So you're not like literally at the tip of the iceberg in terms of identifying possible links. So why do I think this whole exercise of looking at potential gharanas is interesting for the students? It's because if you don't know what people did in a sense before you, as you establish your own gharanas going forward, you won't be able to trace your lineage back to whoever the gurus in a sense of your gharana or your branch of your gharana. So I am done and I can take questions. Nobody has questions.
Very obviously, so when the snail eats its prey, so it must have its own antivenin.
So, yes, it does certainly have antivenins, yes. But in a sense, what would happen is most of these peptides would get digested. So if you're going to eat this, it would not be an issue. Given you have to pretty much inject it into your bloodstream, but you have so many proteases in your gut that you chew up everything in any case, even the worst of the poisons. It's effective when it gets to the neuromuscular junction, which will not happen through your gut. With your gut, you will just chew it all up.
So if there is certain lesion in the gut itself?
Yes, so there is a whole quest actually to identify antivenins for those toxins, because there indeed are for at least some what are called the lightning cabals, very fast toxins, so rapid that the fish that's swimming away has to drop dead instantaneously. Otherwise, the snail, can you imagine having to hunt for where the fish died? It's not even a viable possibility. So it literally has to be an immediate death and has to land somewhere very close to the snail. So yeah, for the lightning cabal, people have begun to find out.
I was wondering, there is this group called iowire.org.
Okay.
So they are using, they have created a game out of these images of possession.
Yes, crowdsourcing to sort of, yeah, to identify. Absolutely, I would say that, because it's part of that whole broad connectome project, right? The idea is that you will have insane amount of data, even from a millimeter cubed of cortex. You're talking about the whole brain and wanting to map everything. This is just not a few people exercise. This is going to be really tough to do. They're also looking at high throughput ways to do this so that you can actually not have to literally figure this out. Certainly manually, this is going to become an impossibility, right? So how do you do this high throughput? Yes, it does.
As in, and can it differentiate between different maps, or overlap, and is there a problem?
Yeah. So there's an overlap across maps. Maps can shrink and expand depending on the size of the territory that the animal is in. So you can expand you can double the territory, and the map will have to now take care of the fact that there's twice the amount of space, let's say in an arena, right? So yes, maps completely overlap. The idea is that you have enough combinatorial possibilities that you would be able to take care of whatever possible space. Plus, you tend to only consolidate those maps that you are actively going through the process of recalling. So the process of recalling a map is sufficient to actually act to consolidate it. So just bringing it back up makes it plastic in a sense. So every time you recall a memory, you transiently make it labile, which is why nothing is actually the actual event, but you're rewriting of that event over and over again. Because every time you recall it, it becomes transiently unstable. So whatever event you're recalling, the minute you recall it, the process of recall makes it unstable. Then you reconsolidate if it's relevant, pull back. And every time you recall, you will do the same thing.
So
So it's in the recitation of the memory or the recitation of the event that explicit memories often morph from what originally happened. They are really a recitation and a repetition of what you remember or you claim actually happened. Yes.
How is that the imaging is what is it all? Is it optical or
there's
still some fluorescent stuff and all that?
No, so you can do it optical as well depending on what you have used to label things inside. So that completely depends. So if you have fluorescently labeled proteins, you may use different approaches, but you can label it with a variety of techniques. And now they're using light sheet expansion microscopy, so you can do substantial terrain and territory of the brain, especially for a rodent brain, that's much more territory than, let's say, for a fly brain. Fly brain, this would not even be an issue because you can actually stack and get much more information. Worm brain, this is not an issue, but mammals, this was certainly an issue. But you can do it for both.
Same subject. I just heard a talk from somebody from Janelia Farms.
Yeah.
They are slicing with an FIB.
Mm-hmm.
What he said is the rate limiting step right now is to reconstruct these slices. And he said it takes a year and a half.
Yes. For EM information, absolutely. But not for the very first pass of information of knowing whether there is a possibility of a connection from one circuit to another. To show the proof of the pudding is really in actually showing the synaptic contact. Just showing that a neuron goes from location X and sends a projection to location Y is not sufficient to tell you who it's synapsing onto, and that's where the rate limiting step comes. You can certainly say it's projecting to this area because you can see the projection. You can guess that it's likely to synapse. It's not going to send a projection otherwise, but to show the synapses, you actually need to reconstruct them. Much, much more, because it's a serial reconstruction of those blocks to literally put it back.
You're saying they're also slicing.
They are, but you're going to get So in a sense, it's not absolutely nailed down. You're close. It will certainly help you where you want to go and do that. You don't have to go on a hunt through the whole brain, but it's still not absolutely nailing it down.
So does it actually mean that if you have a function, something, or something, and then you can freeze the brain?
Absolutely. So in terms of looking at reorganization of pathways, this will be transformative, because right now what people do is they cut a slice, see a change, cut a slice, see a change, cut a slice, see a change, and then try to put everything back together. To be able to look at it at one shot changes the game completely. I mean, you can look at every possible projection coming out at one shot, which was not possible. It just wasn't possible.
So in the patient HM,
mm-hmm.
the hippocampus was removed from the brain.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, I know. That's not really very clear. People have guesses as to why taking out temporal lobe damage might actually do that. There's this whole conflict theory of, things when they come into active recall, that they may actually act to be deterrence to performance on tasks, because tasks are performed really by prefrontal and execution cortices, which are further up. And there's constant dialogue. If you take away this, maybe you take away a constraint, but this is hand waving. Nobody sat and done those kinds. It's difficult to do those kinds of experiments with rodent models. I mean, and that kind of testing, that data was an observation that didn't really get followed up at. Because it's not as clean a lesion as simply taking out the hippocampus. When you look at it, you also see damage to other areas as well. So to be 100% sure it was only hippocampus is hard. It's replicated in animal models very cleanly, that when you take out the hippocampus, the memory part is certainly clear, but the other changes that happen,
It was a number of one, statistics of one.
Seriously. Yeah, I mean, that's one patient. Of course, based on that one patient, there have been hundreds and hundreds of animals in which this has been looked at, and it nails it. I mean, you can silence the hippocampus, you can literally, activate it and look at memory. People have done that, but we would have not known to look at the hippocampus. We could have decided everything is located in some other structure, maybe, completely other structure. Why the hippocampus, there was no...
They did.
So there are temporal, but those are not largely only the hippocampus. It's usually a temporal lobectomy. So you got rid of the amygdala and the hippocampus. So, and they stopped doing those kinds of invasive surgeries after Henry. Given HM had this horrendous situation, they stopped. I mean, which was probably not a bad thing.
Last question.
Yeah, so this is more of again a historical question. When did human
So they, yeah, well, there's all this writing about the fact that there were humors, which, so Aristotle thought the heart was the seat of your intelligence. So at that point in time, intelligence, thought, etc., was thought to be produced from the heart, not from the brain. But they were cutting everything up at that point in time. So they certainly knew the architecture of the brain. And not just that, Chinese medicine, Indian medicine, by that point in time, everything had been dissected. Islamic literature, there's clearly evidence that they had cut and looked at structure. The fact.
The oldest is the tribes in Kuru, where they, you know, started eating the brain because they thought the experiences are stored there.
Yeah, but then that Kuru is an example of the cannibalism evoked, you know, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you can't trace it to anyone, but originally it started with humors. And then I think by about at least, Galen certainly suggested that, you know, the brain may be the seat of higher functions. So he certainly suggested that already. But whether he was the absolute first is a question. I wouldn't want to stick my neck out and say that.
This is, I think, tea, and of course, Satya, like the organizer of asset.